Hello everyone, welcome to Chan Podcast. Here is where you learn about meditation and Chan. So, what is Chan? Chan, spelled as C-H-A-N, is the Chinese school of Mahayana Buddhism and is the originating tradition of Japanese Zen. We encourage you to learn and practice meditation with a group. If you'd like to, feel free to visit our website londonchanmeditation.org.
So tonight I would like to talk about direct contemplation as a method. But in talking about this method, I'd like to talk about the subtle undercurrent of our mind, thoughts and feelings that shape our experience. This is pretty important because the need to expose these undercurrents and the ability to expose these undercurrents lies at the heart of this practice, direct contemplation. Okay, so let me just begin by defining what I mean by direct contemplation. So direct is a translation of 直, which just means straight, the straightforward or unmediated, you could say. And contemplation is the translation of the word 观. This is a tricky word. It means many things, okay. And each of them are related to one another, so it's not either or. So guan can mean observing. It could also mean simply looking. It could also mean contemplation. And this is pre-Buddhist time, right? So the Chinese use this word guan to render the Sanskrit word vipassana, right? Or insight. So what exactly is this guan, this contemplation? We translate it as contemplation, but it's not the Western kind of common association with the word contemplation, as if you're using your mind to reflect on things, ruminate, analyze. It has no meaning like that whatsoever. To contemplate, especially when it's coupled with this word direct, means it's bypassing thinking mind. It's just perceiving, observing. And that is the nature of this method. It's also the nature of many Buddhist methods. Now, in traditional Buddhist context, meditative context, contemplation, vipassana, is itself a kind of vague term, because it can direct to one type of meditation in which the meditator is just experiencing, observing. Popular lingo would be mindful of the object. But Vipassana also includes analytical meditation, in which one's actually using one's thinking to reflect, to analyze. So the object of contemplation. So it has, in the original Buddhist context, in the text, it talks about these two types. So what I'm talking about here is the first one, direct contemplation. So direct contemplation as a method, it's closely linked and founded on the Buddhist notion of valid perception, or immediate or unmediated perception. Unmediated by what? Discursive thinking, narratives, thoughts, language. And all the feeling tones that accompany these thoughts and feelings. Can all of you hear what I'm saying? It's good. Okay. All right. So this is the most important part. Because even when we have insights and some kind of revelation, some kind of transformative experience, usually the feeling tones are still present. And feeling tones are connected to the sense of self. The sense of self is momentarily constructed, momentarily existent, right? By virtue of this habit tendency. Right? So the self-referentiality is connected to these undercurrent feeling tones, subtle thoughts. Now these subtle thoughts are not in our common sense notion of thoughts, as if it's kind of fully formed ideas, right? Language, you know, concepts, right? These feeling tones are much more subtler than that. So they're unformed concepts, right? And they're momentary. And what are they? They're still thoughts. It's just not the thoughts that we think they are as thoughts. Usually when people talk about thoughts, we're talking about, like, I have a thought of this, thought of that, like a thought of an image, thought of an object. These are fully formed ideas, fully formed concepts. Sometimes when people talk about thoughts, they actually can hear what they're referring to is just their own monologue. Like they can hear them thinking of this and that. Like a wandering thought. You know, when people sit in meditation, wandering thoughts kind of push and pull us from here to there. That's what normally people talk about is thoughts. Of course they are. But they are not the undercurrent feeling tone that I'm talking about. These are moods, unformed thoughts, ever present. connected to our sense of self. For example, now how many of you have had this experience in which, you know, one day you wake up, you just feel like you're not yourself today? It's not actually thinking. You're not referring to, you know, I thought about this and I don't usually think like that, so it's not myself. Or you thought about that, or you feel this thing. It's just this kind of undercurrent mood. How many of you have felt like that? Raise your hand. So that is kind of close to what I'm talking about. It's not this and not that. Nothing that you can kind of pinpoint. Not certain ideas. It's just this experiencing of yourself. And that undercurrent, mood, attitude, feeling tone, that's connected to our sense of self. So our sense of self is momentarily existent, constructed and formed through these very subtle feelings. From them, we generate, thoughts and ideas, fully formed notions, ideas, perceptions. That's where we have the wandering thoughts. That's where we have the, you know, hateful thinking, self-disparaging ideas, you know, arrogant notions, calculative, manipulative thinking, and also joy and happiness. You know. So, excitement and feeling of gratitude, for example. And it is all these, I mean, to give an analogy, it would be, these feeling tones would be like the building blocks almost. To use atoms as an example, like these building blocks of forms, fully formed ideas, like gratitude. You could call them neurological synapses, this synaptic momentary formations of experiencing. So how does all that relate to meditation? The whole course of Dharma practice is to expose all the wandering thoughts, all the subtle undercurrent tones, these subtle thoughts, not being swayed by them, not being manipulated by them, not following them, not suppressing them either. But we have to be aware. So this wakefulness to what is present itself is in alignment with awakening. These subtle undercurrent tones themselves are also what I often say, furniture in the room. Now, most of the time, we are simply aware of the elephants in the room, like the furniture, anger thoughts, you know, self-disparaging thoughts, you know, feeling depressed, you know, big furniture in the room, right? And they preoccupy us. And we have such habitual identity with them that we don't see anything else. When we feel sad, when we feel grief, that's all we feel, right? Which is consumed by it. There's this momentum. Attachment, our connection, you can say, to the event, to the people, and that consumes our energy, so we don't see anything else. But in the spaciousness of this room of our mind, our heart, there's a lot of different furniture. In fact, the big feelings that we have are constructed through all these other furniture, right? These building blocks. So part of the practice, that, and all of that, it's connected to this habitualized ways of the sense of self, the sense of self that we feel, that we experience. So the Buddhist path, Buddha Dharma, this whole project, if you will, is to expose the sense of self, to accept it fully. You have to know what we're working with, right? And to work with it, and then to be able to free ourselves from it. Why? Because the sense of self, however virtuous or however harmful, is the source of our experiencing, is the source of the limitation and the skewed ways of experiencing, which more often than not, because the nature of this sense of self, it's always reifying, solidifying things into fixed perspectives, separate, independent. So it's not connected. It doesn't stem from this place of connection. So the very nature of this sense of self creates the sense of other and me, I, mine. So it's always polarizing. So a person may be a good guy, kind person, but still this potential is there. This potential to polarize, to separate, to demonize others, or othering things. Therefore, it creates suffering for oneself and others around. So it's very important to understand and to expose the workings, the inner workings of this sense of self-referentiality. And one way to do that in concrete terms is to work with thoughts and feelings. Now, I'm using the word thoughts and feelings, but really, it's just thoughts. Feelings are just undercurrent, subtle tones made up of these building block thoughts. So this is the concrete way we transform ourselves, concrete way we work with our vexations, shortcomings, and develop virtuous qualities, transform harmful tendencies into beneficial ones, and not be tethered to even the beneficial ones. How to see the nature of mind? Mind. There's no such thing as mind. Mind is made up of non-minds. What are non-minds? Thoughts. These undercurrents. These unformed habitual tendencies. That's ever present. So this is why it's so important for charm practitioners, particularly. And these subtle feeling tones are ever present in wakeful and sleeping states, these undercurrents. And they are definitely in, you know, when we feel down, when we feel vexed, of course, we feel the vexations. We know that's, you know, greed, hatred, ignorance. But it's much more subtle than that. They're also present in powerful, transformative experiences of unification, oneness. Now, oneness in Buddha Dharma is not liberation. Because these self-referential tendencies are still present, this habitual sense of self is still present. It may take the whole world as a self, in a sense, a self expands to include everything, being connected to all, but the self is still there. It's just a unified self. And there are subtle feeling tones there. For example, one time, intensive retreat, one of my teachers, long-time student, we're doing direct contemplation. Now, usually direct contemplation is given as a supporting method during intensive retreats, maybe the fourth day or fifth day, you know, later down, then it becomes more effective, right? Otherwise, you know, people can't directly contemplate anything. They're just wrapped up in wandering thoughts. So I'll talk about the method in a few minutes, which is actually very simple, right? But extremely hard to do. Anyway, so we were doing this direct contemplation, bracketing all of our thoughts, feelings, notions, narratives, words and language, labels. Usually we meditate on sight or sound. So this practitioner, long-time practitioner, was contemplating, you know, we're outdoor, right? Contemplating a tree. And it was fall season. So he was contemplating a tree. And we've been practicing intensely for days, you know, 16 hours a day, you know, meditation. So it was very intense. So the wandering discursive thinking is already passed, subsided. So just direct experiencing. So he's using sight, just resting the gaze at the tree. Not labeling the tree, not giving a word. It's almost like a priori perception before the words tree or some label. Just experience. Moment to moment to moment to moment experiencing sight. And all of a sudden, because it was fall season, the wind blew. And the tree leaves start to fall. Just falling. Along with the wind. And as he was witnessing that astonishing moment, because he was completely connected, he wasn't othering the tree, an object outside him. He was one with the tree. He was the tree. And when the foliage started to blow in the wind, he started to have tears. Not joy, nor sadness, melancholy. It was the subtle, subtle undercurrent, tones. But putting that aside, he was in tears. And the period was over, the gong hits, you know, the bell, and everyone went inside. He walked over to the tree. He kind of bowed. He picked up a leaf and went inside. And what follows was personal interview. It was his turn. So he presented this leaf, right? He presented this leaf to my teacher. And he's just feeling overwhelmed, this gratitude. It wasn't thought. There are no concrete thinking, thoughts of gratitude. It's just this undercurrent feeling tone. He was one with everything, and he presented this to the teacher, my teacher. And my teacher took that leaf, threw it out, and in that moment, he experienced this, it was this astonishment, like suddenly, like a part of him was kind of ripped, you know, and, you know, he was in tears, you know. Now, why was he? Because he was in the state of unification, oneness. He didn't see the tree outside. The leaf was him. The tree was him. My teacher was him. So that gesture, in that whole scenario, was you are me, but I'm not you. So he got the first part. You are me. Everything is me. But he still had a long way to go. Nothing is you. So this may be hard to understand. What is actually present? The sense of self. Not the individual self, not the self of our ordinary daily life, but the expansive, unified self. It's almost like St. Francis speaking of the sun, the bird, as him. In the Catholic tradition, that's unification. That's a kind of oneness. Or when someone says, You know, love thy enemy. I wonder who said that. Or, you know, you are me. Right? Because it's like the left hand trying to fight with the right hand. There's no enemy. Everything is me. Is there a self there? There's a self there. Now, this practitioner had a shallower experience of that. So traces of the undercurrent feeling tones are still there, tied to that sense of self. So my teacher, all he had to do is just test it. Now I was the translator, so I was present. All he had to do is just test it. Take this thing, throw it away, see how he responds. Or just, you know, someone present with you this, he says, what is it? Tell me, what is this? See how that person is connecting with other things, other human beings. And if you take it away, see how that experience is. So, even in powerful, transformative experiences of oneness, or some insight, you know, some people mistaken, very common mistake, when they have a temporary subsiding of the sense of self-referentiality, temporary, in which it's just clarity, unified state, because that obstruction is not there anymore. The sense of self is not there temporarily. They mistaken that to be awakening. In those states, people have all kinds of powerful emotions. Now, it's tricky. Sometimes these emotions are just kind of residue. But sometimes it's connected to the sense of self. So it depends on the teacher to see what is actually experienced in that state. So a sense of release or sense of openness and clarity and connection. So in speaking with the teacher, just regular conversation, the teacher will be able to tell whether the self is present or not. So even in those powerful experiences, these undercurrent feeling tones are still there. And because people are not used to exposing them, they're not familiar with the workings of these subtle tones. So when they have a powerful religious experience, insight, what they perceive as awakening, they don't see it. They don't see that working of the sense of self. Right, so self is still there. But what's wrong with that? Nothing's really wrong with it. You know, religions are founded on these experiences, right? But Buddha Dharma or Chan, not necessarily a religion. It has religious components, but we're talking about liberation, which is not religious experience. Why? Because the culprit of suffering is still there. Because it's still there, the causes of suffering is still there. So suffering and the cause of suffering are not uprooted. So it will create suffering for humanity, for others, for oneself, sooner or later. Sooner or later, in Chan we say, the fox's tail will be exposed. The wild fox. Now, fox in East Asian culture is considered cunning, sly. You know, so sooner or later, some harm is going to come out. And even if it's genuine experience of genuine letting go, liberation, transcendence of self, the self still comes back because of habit tendency. So we need to engage in practice continually, again and again, 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 again. So have these powerful experiences of letting go. And to do that, you have to expose the workings of the self. In the West, people identify more strongly with the sense of feeling. If you go to East Asia, if you ask them, who are you? They will tell you their what they do, the roles that they play, the kind of station in life, the kind of positioning in relation to the network of, you know, their family, their work, and so on. If you come to the West, you ask people, who are you? How do you gauge your sense of self? People will go directly to their feelings, usually. These how they feel. This is all that they've ever known. I feel not myself today, or I feel good today, I feel this and that. Not so much, you know, if they're a CEO of a company, or they're a janitor at a school, the roles that they play. Not so much, but how they actually feel. What they privilege is their experience. That's tricky, because the self is hidden, concealed in these feelings, in these experiences. But seldom are these feelings and experiences challenged by themselves. I'm not saying challenge other people's feelings. I'm talking about like questioning our own feelings. Seldom. The mood that they feel. So this is like all that we've ever known, that we identify as our sense of being in the world. Not necessarily the monologues, the chattering, but the feelings. That must be questioned. It must be exposed. Must be exposed in the midst of experiencing the ups and downs of life. It's not to say that, you know, the problems that we experience are all come from ourselves. Nothing wrong with the world. Of course, there's a lot of things wrong with the world. There's a lot of injustice in the world. And the world needs help. But we are part of it. Our experiencing is part of it. So, in that process of engaging with others, engaging the world, we have to understand how we feel, what we are experiencing, and not necessarily be tethered, bound by that. There's so much freedom within us. You are not bound by your thoughts. You are not your feelings. If you are your feelings, your experiences, then which one is it? The happy one or the sad one? This or that? Every one of those feelings, they come and go. Just like the furniture in this room. The furniture is not the space. The spaciousness is your inexhaustible potential. It is your natural awakening. It is your freedom. There's no need to be bound by them, to be defined. There's no need to reify, solidify, limit ourselves. There's so much to each of you. Infinite potential. Because you're already free. You're already awakened. But, there's a big but we're bound by these furniture. We're tied down. Tethered, locked, chained by habit tendencies, patterns of thinking, that which we have always known, this undercurrent feeling tone that shapes our experience. So the first step is to expose that. And here, a segue to the importance of direct contemplation. A simpler term to talk about direct contemplation. So direct contemplation is a term that my teacher came up with, which I simply call experiencing. Experiencing. So contemplation in this sense is not rumination. It's actually just wakeful experiencing, unmediated by thoughts, labels, discrimination, comparison, words and language. So here's the practice. It works best in an intensive retreat setting when we first learn it. After a few days, several days of sitting, after wandering thoughts have somewhat subsided. But even if they're present, it's fine. We can still have glimpses of this direct perception. So the method is this. Because most of our vexations come from sight and sound, okay? The gossips we hear, the things that someone's words, or the forms that we see, the injustices that we witness, the actions of people. Most of our vexations come from sight and sound. So we have to start with them, confront that. Now, we're bracketing the actual social injustices in the world. We're talking about meditation practice, so that we can better engage with the world, right? But for now, we're not talking about there's no evil or there's no problem with the world. Of course they are. But we have to expose what's shaping that experience of sight and sound. And that shaping of it, interpreting of it, experiencing of it, is these undercurrent tones. So, choose an object, one, sight or sound, not both in the beginning, right? Sight or sound. Second, the object of meditation must be steady. So if you contemplate sound, you don't want to choose something like birds chirping. You may be in a place outdoors, a lot of birds chirping, very beautiful sounds. But sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not. You can't have that. You gotta have a method, like always there, to return to. So a sound that's constant, a form that's relatively constant. Right? Three. Don't use words, language, labels. Definitely don't compare. Don't discriminate. Definitely no narratives about it. Four. Let me rewind back to three. So how do you do it then? Don't know. Just maintain this not knowing openness, like a beginner's mind. No preconceived ideas. You don't know what it is. Even if you're looking at a tree, you know it's a tree, but no words. You don't know what it is. Tree is actually made up of non-tree. Which part is a tree? The bark? The tree? Or is it the root or branches? Or is it a leaf? Or is it which part is the tree? Or is the minerals that's inside? Or the water? Moisture? Tree is made up of non-tree. It's just a word. It doesn't mean anything. So don't label it. Just a sense of wonder. Not knowing. Open. Receptive. Right? So four. Present moment. Very important. So you're just staying with this experiencing wakeful present. Five, this wakeful presence, it's something that it's already here. Just like the eyes see, ears hear, the mind experience. You don't have to try to experience. Experiencing is already here. So just rest in this experiencing of sight. Of sight. Steady. No words and language. No comparison. And not changing. And stay in the present. Stay in the present. So when you do this, you have to prime the body and mind. So you relax the body, and then you place yourself in a state clear, neither grasping nor rejecting. Don't try to change anything. Don't try to fix anything. Don't try to get rid of anything. Don't suppress anything either. Just being present. Rest in sight. Just experience, 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 experience. So you learn to experience things without narratives. First, now stages of practice. Possibly. You know, it's not like a blueprint in which you have to go through these stages. Not necessarily. Sometimes a person can jump right into the state. Sometimes a person staying one in a long time and suddenly jump into another. Right? So what are some of the signposts, if you will, of what you might experience? Well, first, when you sit down, our automatic habituation start to label things. That's the most common things. Right? So you just have to be aware, as if you're aware of wandering thoughts, right? Which it is, wandering thoughts. And just return to just seeing. It's almost like allowing the sight to come to you. This is the key. You're not projecting your sight out there to look at something. You're allowing it to come to you. So what is happening is you begin to experience seeing. Not experience that which is seen, like the object, or that which is heard, like you're going out to hear something. Don't do that. Allow them to come to you. And you will begin to, first, you may have some habits of labeling things, putting a word to what you're seeing. Just let them go naturally. Allow them to evaporate in the presence of experiencing. Because if you do this, of not going out, but allowing things to come here, you begin to experience the sight, experience the hearing, not the heard, not the object. Right? And in that, experiencing, your sensory perceptions may become more vivid, may become even, experientially, it may even actually become bright. Like if you're looking at something, you may start to see bright. This is just tricks, your visual cortex is playing on you. Don't get so excited. Don't get wound up. Don't reify, solidify, and just to make a thing out of it, which is what we tend to do. We make a thing out of everything. Don't do that, right? That's what Buddha said. That's what in Buddhism called attachments, right? Don't make a big deal out of it. Just whatever comes up, just go back to the experiencing of sight. Experiencing of sight. And stay in that freshness of the present. So get a hang of doing this, practicing it, And by doing so, the boundaries that we usually create as discursive thinking diminishes, that's the culprit that creates a sense of self and sense of others. So as that diminishes, the actual boundaries between you being here and the world also start to blur. That's the experience of oneness. It's just an altered state of consciousness. That's why it's not awakening. Awakening is not altered state of consciousness. It's not religious experience. It's just the absence of vexations, self-referential tendencies. So these altered states of experience, oneness you feel with the sight, light, or a real sense of connection, identity, in those moments, the subtle undercurrent tones will start to change, manifest. Maybe some gratitude that you feel with the tree or with the sound, or some or a genuine sense of connection that you experience, embody. Right? Self is still there. Continue. Expose, expose, expose the present scene. Right, so these are some of the potential things that can come up, right, from wandering thought to some real experiences, you know, diminishing of self-referential attachments. So the individual self drops away, the kind of unified self manifests, start to manifest. And accompanied with that, these feeling tones will change. So get used to doing that. Get used to, at the very least, this practice is very beneficial because it brackets our usual projection onto other people or situations, our own ideas. The Buddhist term is prapancha, right, which is proliferation of notions mistaken to be the actual thing. So we usually have our own notions conflated with the actual experience of the thing. We can't tell the difference. Like if Joe, we like Joe, we conflate it with our liking. And if we don't like him, we conflate our own notions of negative experiences with Joe. We don't actually experience Joe. Right? Joe has changed. So at the very least, when we practice this, you know, after a period of sitting, daily sitting, even you can just introduce a little bit. When you're coming out of sitting, going through, you know, do the massage and then going getting a drink of water, just experience direct contemplation of the things that you're experiencing, drinking water, right? Or looking at things, or when you're in the park, experience bracketing everything. Just experience the vivid aliveness of the present experiencing of sight or sound. Right? So that will start to bleed into your meditation practice, your formal meditation practice, and changing it up to be a kind of direct contemplation of breath, direct contemplation of silent illumination, direct contemplation of koan, huato practice, you know, or reciting the Buddha's name. So it will start to fuse, and that's good. Right? So that wakeful, vivid clarity, free from discursive thinking, will start to arise, freeing you from, you know, notions, thoughts, and feelings. That will be the first, right? And then you will start to expose the undercurrent feeling tones. That too, expose, bracket, let go. So become closer and closer in alignment with how things actually are, without self and others. What needs to be done? What can be done? And that starts to lead into the choices that you make in daily life. You can distinguish between your own prapancha, your own proliferation of notions projected onto things, with the actual thing itself. You can put it aside. Most people can't distinguish. If I don't like you, I just don't like you, right? You're just that jerk, right? They can't distinguish between, I think you're a jerk. Doesn't necessarily mean that person is a jerk, right? That person's best friend thinks he's the greatest guy in the world, right? So different people experience reality differently because they bring their own baggage. It's like bringing your own lunch to the picnic. We don't really experience a picnic. We just eat what we bring. So that will have tremendous benefit in your daily life. So direct contemplation, traditionally, how we practice in Chan, is a supporting method. Right? We practice and gain some experience, and then it will start to benefit your primary method. But the way I teach it, that itself is also a primary method. And I've turned it into a primary method in my teaching on embodied experiencing. So anyway, that's another topic. So start with one sense faculty, sight or sound. In that one session, you don't switch. In the next session, if you want to practice, you can switch to another one. But one at a time, one at a time. To get comfortable doing that. And then you will see the benefits in daily life. So the comings and goings of thoughts and feelings, you'll no longer be so tied to it. Even those undercurrent feeling tones that shapes our experience, which is a sense of self, you're more sensitized to it. So you won't be tricked by some powerful religious experience. You can keep going. That's the point.